Good evening, everyone. So welcome to the second class on karma. So just a reminder to silence your cell phone, if everyone can take a second and do that. And then all of the homework and handouts, I do post each week online. So if you just go to kadampacenter.org and then go to Discovering Buddhism Materials, you can scroll down and see all of the classes we've done so far. And there's a group of information on karma. So far there's a homework. There's the All About Karma handout that's out there, the handout that Don brought last week, as well as that inner job description handout that we were picking up last week as well. Tonight, at the end of class, Karen, for anyone that wants to stay, Karen Beasley over here, will meet you all kind of in the back of the Gompa to talk about maybe starting up a discussion group for after class to kind of chat about what happened during class and any questions about reading, just an informal discussion group. So if you're interested in that, please stay after class and just kind of gather in the back. And I think that's it. We'll get started. Yeah. I'll check the AC. And another reminder, we do stream this class, so if you have a comment or a question, wait for the microphone and we'll let the folks that are streaming hear us.
Wake up, little Susie, wake up. Okay. So we're going to start out with the prayers. I was just talking to Dr. Watkins about it. He always likes to do the prayers to begin with. I think that's a good idea. In fact, I like to do prostrations to start out with. So those of you who are interested in doing half prostrations as an antidote to arrogance and purifying your body, speech and mind, and opening up your chakras, and all kinds of good things happen when we prostrate. So we're paying homage to the enlightened beings, but also our potential to become enlightened. So we're paying homage to that. We're paying homage to the realizations, the Dharma, what's called the Dharma, but also our potential to realize those truths within our mind stream. And the Sangha are those, you know, the beings, the so-called Arya beings that have had direct intuitive insight into emptiness, but then our potential to actually be that person who can have that insight and also help others to achieve it. So it's a very profound practice. So anyway, we'll do it three times if you're able. And by the way, there's a mantra that goes along with it that multiplies it 10 million times, which I will do. If you know the mantra, you can do it too. Om namo manjushriye, namo susriye, namo uttamasriye, so on. Om namo manjushriye, namo susriye, namo uttamasriye, so on. Om namo manjushriye, namo susriye, namo uttamasriye, so on. So sit up straight in your chair, those of you who are in a chair, feet flat on the floor. You can make a little circle with your arms if you want to. It's nice. If you sit for long periods of time, which we won't be doing here, but if you ever do, it's nice to have a little ventilation, keeps things a little aerated, and it's comfortable. You want your shoulders down and slightly back. Your chin's a little tucked in a knot. Like this makes you sleepy. Like this makes your mind swirl. So you want your head in a neutral position, but slightly tucked in. It's actually helpful to keep the eyes slightly open because it lets a little bit of light in. But some people are more comfortable closing their eyes. We were going to do the prayers, but I just got carried away here with this. So then the tongue is at the roof of the mouth. And again, if you're sitting for any period of time, it channels the saliva down the back of your throat. So you're not, you know, interrupting your meditation by having to swallow all the time. So these are the kind of the key points. The spine is straight, like you're having checkers stacked one on top of the other. The vertebrae are just stacked upright, and just sitting in this position has a kind of quieting effect on the mind. So we're going to do our little meditation like we did last time, where you're exhaling and then inhaling. That's one. And then exhaling and inhaling is two. And so on up to 10. And then when you get to 10, most likely you'll lose count at about 3. Or four, and when you do, just without berating yourself for being a bad meditator, which we all are, very difficult to, in the beginning, to discipline the mind. We're not used to it. So you start over again. You get to 4 and you get lost. You start over again. And you get to 3 and you get lost and you start over again. And sometimes you don't even get past 1 and then you start over again. You just begin again each time without a lot of judgment, criticism. And again, the contract we have with ourselves is to focus, like we have two guards at each nostril, and they're watching our breath as it goes in and out. So we want to be very, very vigilant, rigorous about keeping our mind focused on the exhalation and the inhalation. So we'll do this for maybe 20 minutes. We'll do it for 20 minutes. Let's say 15. I think that's good. And then we'll end up with a little analytical, contemplative meditation to set the motivation. Sit still too, by the way. You want to be with your hands in your lap. You can have them. Traditionally, we do it like this. The left hand, right hand on top of the left, and the thumbs touching at the navel level. But you can do anything with your hand. Just be comfortable and be still. And if you find yourself getting lost in thought, you just bring the mind back to the experience of breathing, the sensation of the breath at the nostrils, and begin again. Exhale, and then inhale, and that's one, and so on. also the most important part of the evening is setting proper motivation for listening to the teachings, hopefully finding something of value, putting it into practice, having our lives work better, not only for our sake, but for the sake of others. So all of this is based on a notion of universal compassion, it's really easy to have compassion for the people that we love, that are near and dear. Whereas the people that we dislike, when they suffer, we actually might rejoice. So suffering, being aware of suffering alone, or dukkha, or as Geshe-la calls it, complications, whatever you want to say, it's suffering, it hurts, it's painful. Just being aware of that doesn't cause compassion to arise. Have to feel connection, have to feel some kind of warmth, connection to others. And so the basis for that is equanimity. So you might bring... So a good place to start is with yourself, with this practice. Wishing as you breathe out, say, think, may I be happy and have the causes of happiness. And as you breathe in, think, may I be free of suffering and its causes. So let's do that a couple of times. As you breathe out silently, we say, may I have happiness and its causes. As we breathe in, may I be free of suffering and its causes. Then bring to mind a friend, someone that you're attached to, that you feel close to, and again repeat the same process, but this time may you, this person, whoever they are, may you be happy, may you have happiness and its causes on the exhalation. And on the inhalation, may you be free of suffering and its causes. And then think of someone that you feel neutral toward. Like the vast majority of beings we don't know. And I'm not just talking about human beings, but beings in all the different realms. But we can imagine like the faceless person in the line at the grocery store or in the elevator, or people that that are driving, in front of us as we go into work, that all this vast majority of people that we have we feel indifference toward. So let's think, wish them happiness and to be free of suffering. On the exhalation, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. And on the inhalation, may you be free of suffering and its causes. And then the hardest one to do is the person that we feel some aversion toward. You know, we use the term enemy. You may be lucky enough to have a really good enemy you could use in this meditation, but just anybody that you feel some aversion toward, somebody that just you just don't feel comfortable in their presence, somebody you have some negative energy on, could be from even going back to your childhood. You bring to mind that person, and you again think, may you have happiness and its causes, and be free of suffering and its causes. And then we'll try to develop some sort of equanimous attitude toward these three categories of beings, the friends, the strangers, and the enemies. And we can use different lines of reasoning. Just the meditation we just did is to develop, is to at least open up the mind toward the possibility of having thoughts of love and compassion toward these beings, but they all want to be happy. No one wants to suffer, and these labels, friends, stranger, and enemy, are all very impermanent because they can change. Friends can become enemies, enemies can become friends. strangers can become either one. It's just nothing fixed about these labels. So this is the attitude of equanimity that we need to develop, to develop universal compassion. And then we think that all these beings are just like me. They all want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. We're all exactly alike in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. Even though we ordinarily think our happiness is more important than anybody else's, here we're training ourselves to see that everyone is exactly the same, equally wanting happiness and equally wanting to be free of suffering. Then we reflect briefly on the causes of all the problems. It's self-centered selfishness, period. That's the devil. That's the problem, is that we project, it's instinctive, but we do it anyway. We project a sense of self, which of course is valid. There's a valid sense of self. We do exist. There's no, that's not the question here. The problem is that we have we project this false sense of self, and then we cling to it as if it was most precious. So anything that offends me becomes a problem. And anything that I want also becomes a problem for attachment. And so on. So all of, in Buddhism we say all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time until now is a cause of one demon, the selfish, self-cherishing mind. Worth checking out. And the cause of all happiness is its opposite, the mind that cherishes others, holds them most precious. For happiness, I was up at a bumper sticker one time, for happiness, cherish others. So easy. For happiness, all we have to do is cherish others. And then there's this exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing for cherishing others, which ordinarily our focus is on me, me, I, but now we're going to exchange the attitude so that whatever we do for others. Whatever we do for others. Before it was all about me, now it's about others. So we exchange an attitude. We're not becoming somebody else. We're just exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing for the attitude of cherishing others. And then the supreme wish that kind of evolves along with in this analytical meditation is that when we feel connected to all living beings and we notice, we see others suffering and we see how everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. We're all the same and we want to help. And so we make this vow. This is the vow of the spiritual warrior, the bodhisattva. Being who's on the path to Buddhahood, and their attitude, and it's a state of mind, not because if it could be done, it would have been done, but the attitude is, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all living beings. I take personal responsibility for guiding all living beings from their present state of confusion and dissatisfaction and dukkha and suffering and guiding them to the state of full enlightenment, which is complete freedom from suffering, developing all of our qualities, all the qualities that we do have, compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, skillful means. We all have those, but they can be cultivated endlessly. So we fully develop qualities. So I'm going to guide beings from confusion to full enlightenment by myself alone. It's not anybody else's job, it's my job. So right away, a lot of people go, wait a minute, I'm not ready for this. But this is the attitude that leads to the next step, which is bodhicitta's awakening mind, which is, by the way, the quickest way to accumulate vast amount of good karma, is to develop this attitude. And it's that we dedicate our life to supreme enlightenment. In other words, eliminating our faults, developing our qualities in order to be able to help others, to guide others. So it's like, I must become enlightened. I must develop these qualities and eliminate my faults so I can truly be a benefit. And when we look at the reality, we can't even take care of ourselves. We haven't even got our act together. But this is the goal. This is the aspiration. This altruistic intention to become enlightened, which is based on love and compassion for all living beings. As if you can even develop, it's one thing to just an interest in the beginning is effortful. It's not easy. It's not our instinct. But if we can just develop some appreciation for this attitude, that's a good start. And with that motivation, then we can gradually open your eyes, and we'll have this intention to carry through the entire teaching tonight and up to the dedication. It's always important in the beginning to set this altruistic intention. So you can open your eyes and bring your awareness back into the room. Is that working yet? Oh, it died. Pardon? Okay. So while we're waiting for it to come on, any questions about last week, about homework, about karma? Pretty interesting crowd we got here. Yeah. Okay, good. So one of the things that we talk about in Buddhism is past and future lifetimes. And karma really doesn't make any sense, does it, without positing past and future lifetimes. You could just say this lifetime. But, you know, then how would... The karma basically is an explanation for everything. Everything that happens to us. So there are things that happen to, you know, to babies in the womb, to children, to as we grow up. There are so many things that happen. We don't have an explanation for it just based on what's happened in this lifetime. We use the example of somebody coming in here last week and mowing us all down, you know, and we can't. None of us probably are, you know, serial killers or mass murderers or anything like that. So we haven't really, at least we don't remember having created the causes for that. But nothing happens, and nothing, according to karma, nothing happens without a reason. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Let's go over here. And I'll fill up. Now this is something that I got from... Joan Nicell. She's the lady that... You know, when Lama Zopa's typing and everything at these at the retreats, Joan is the one that does the typing. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the You guys got to hang with me here for a minute. This is first time I've done this way before. Oh yeah, this is good stuff right here. Four characteristics of karma. We could do the whole night on this one. Okay? This is a meditation, which we'll probably do at the end. But the let's talk about the four... No. Wait a minute. Let's go back. Because I said we'd go over the homework. And this is a good good teaching points. Here we go. How many people had a chance to go over the quiz? Anybody? One? Okay, good. All right. So this is a good way to organize the class. All right, so the three ways to understand phenomena. So we talked about karma as not being anything that you necessarily you could fully explain, right? You know, some things you can explain, but other things you cannot. Karma is sort of a hidden teaching. So these are the ways that we understand things, through direct senses, we see it. We can use logic and analysis. We talked about this. Now, there's going to be some repetition, and that's okay. We need to hear things multiple times, and then reliance on the teachings of the Buddha. So here we are on karma. We're relying on the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha was called the omniscient one. So he knew everything. Omniscience means all knowing. So the Buddha was seen, and you don't have to buy it, but the Buddhist perspective is that the Buddha was omniscient. So the answer to that one is what? Yeah. These are indeed the three ways. We'll see how we do on the exam here in a minute. All right. Karma, with its details and complexities, is a type of phenomena that can be understood completely by means of logic and analysis. No way. No way. We can't understand why somebody would come in here and shoot us up, or why, you know, a newborn baby would end up in the NICU and you know, die from sepsis, or so many things that we don't have. We can see, yeah, if you don't brush your teeth, you get cavities. Or if you punch somebody, you know, you're going to get punched back. Or if you run a red light, that's easy. That's cause and effect. That's also karma, but it's deeper than that. So, answer's false, right? We'll go with false. It's only possible to understand karma through reliance on the knowledge of the Buddha. Only the Buddha is able to trace all the causes responsible for a particular phenomenon, such as, for example, the causes of each of the colors of a peacock's feather. Isn't that a great question? But it's true. The Buddha was omniscient. So the Buddha knew the causes for everything, or knows the causes for everything. The Buddha's. So the answer is, we can only understand karma through reliance on the Buddha. But there's some teachings in karma that are really helpful. And we're going to go over these. Right. A lot of these are in this in this exam, I think. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah, but it says that it's only possible to understand karma through reliance on the knowledge of the Buddha. I thought that in our discussion last week that we talked about how there was encouragement to use the way to know knowledge is through experience as your way to understand karma. And for myself, since I'm someone who tends to not know things through someone else telling me it,
right,
I identified with that pretty strongly. And so now hearing a recommendation that you can only know it through someone else telling you it, that seems odd to me.
It does. But it's true. I can explain it. Well, first of all, it is important to try to validate the accuracy of the teachings. And yet, when you get into karma, some parts of karma are, you can't prove it to yourself. Why did that baby die in the NICU? What karmically did that child do to justify being, being a victim of strep infection in the NICU and die? We don't know that. We can't. I mean, we might be able to figure it out, but karmically speaking, there are so many causes that are impossible for us to realize. But let me go through this, because there's a lot of stuff about karma that we can understand, that we can put into practice. And here's the other thing that's very interesting. The Dalai Lama said this. He said, because karma is sort of a hidden teaching, when you really start looking, he said, but the teachings on emptiness, are you familiar with emptiness, what we're talking about, emptiness? He said, the teachings on emptiness, where we talked about last week about how there's nothing, where's my pen? I left it. Here's my mala. Yeah. I mean, you see these beads. I mean, everybody's seeing something different, aren't they? Nobody's seeing the same thing. We're all having a different experience of our entire lives. There's nothing out there that exists independent of our mind labeling it. So we say that it looks like when I'm looking out here, it looks like you guys are all out there and it has nothing to do with me labeling you, man, woman, people, whatever. Doesn't it? It doesn't look like I'm doing anything. It's just happening. You guys are out there and I'm over here. We call this dualistic thinking. But in fact, it's dynamic. It's dynamic. There's nothing out there that exists independent. Now, there's data. Don't get me wrong. But there's nothing that exists independent of the mind labeling it. So the Buddha's greatest teaching is on interdependence. We talk about dependent arising or everything is interdependent. So even our perception of reality has to do with this interdependence where, again, our karma, which has created all of these little, what do we call them? I want to say slides, but frames of the video camera in our head, for example, when we're looking out, our karma, our past actions have planted seeds, these little frames, and forcing us to see a room full of people and ourselves at the Kadampa Center. You can't say that you're in downtown Raleigh and be valid. I mean, you could say that, but it wouldn't be valid, would it? The valid perception is that we're here at Kadampa Center. So our mind is creating our reality all the time. There is no inherent existence. There's nothing that's not empty of inherent existence. We call it the wisdom of emptiness, shunyata. This was the big aha that the Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree. So that's something that through analysis and reasoning and, and just using our experience, we can see that that's actually true. Now, it might not be, I may not be doing a very good job, and I'm not, of explaining it right now, but it can be proven through the use of analysis and just using your mind to analyze the nature of reality. You can see things don't exist the way they appear. They don't. And so the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, says, once you develop faith in the teachings on emptiness, then you are more open to these more hidden teachings on karma. So I'm going to leave it at that. That's just where we are. Okay? Uh-oh, we lost them again. Where are my girls? Here we go. Uh-oh. I had great aspirations for this. Here we go. All right, so here we are. Karma is defined as a law of cause and effect. Yeah, I think we'll go with yes. What do you think? Yeah. It's also defined as action as well as what? Attention, intention, or perception. Intention. Now, I have a hard time understanding that, but karma is, the Sanskrit word karma means action, and which implies reaction, action and reaction. It's also, you know, in the teachings, it's defined as intention. Now, you know, when we talk about motivation, sometimes we use the words motivation and intention interchangeably. But the key factor in karma is intention. It's the key factor. So, really important. I mean, you could, for example, if you give it's Christmas time and, you know, you're giving gifts to people and you do it out of sincere generosity, and you don't care whether, you know, you don't expect anything in return. You know, you're doing it, your motivation is sincere generosity. That's quite different than giving something and expecting something in return, or wanting to be, you know, wanting people to think well of you because you're such a generous person. So intention's like a key factor in karma. In terms of time, karma can only ripen in this lifetime or in the next lifetime immediately following this lifetime. Answer, true or false? What's the answer? Pardon? Yeah. So if it's very strong karma, positive or negative, could ripen in this lifetime. I mean, if we got enlightened in this lifetime, it would be because of really amazing karma ripening in this lifetime, wouldn't it? So positive actions or negative actions can ripen even in this lifetime. Really powerful ones. So karma can ripen in this lifetime. By the way, they're called the immediate, sort of guaranteed to get you in trouble big time. It's killing your mother, your father, or a Buddha, drawing the blood of an arhat, a holy being. By the way, I had to draw blood from Lama Zopa a couple of times. That really made me nervous. I said, am I going to get in trouble? he's our teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Anyway. So he said, no problem. Your motivation's good. So, you know, those are things that give immediate bad reactions. So in terms of karma, can only ripen. So this lifetime, the next lifetime, or infinite future lifetimes. It could be 3 lifetimes or 50 bazillion lifetimes from now. What causes the karma to ripen? Like if you did something, like you practiced generosity at Kadampa Center, let's say. You gave a nice, you know, with sincerely made an offering of like $1 at Kadampa Center. Then somewhere down the road, you know, what would be the if what would be the karmic fruit of generosity? What goes around comes around. Let me get my. I should have brought my boomerang tonight. I've got one at home. I'm bringing it. I'll bring it next week. What goes around comes around. So the cause of wealth or prosperity is generosity. So it could be that $1, like somebody could give you like, you know, $10 tonight, for example, on the way home, because karma expands. And the karma, we'll talk about it in a minute, but karma is like expanding, growing constantly, okay? Or it could ripen in some future lifetime, winning the lottery, you know, winning $50 million in the lottery. That $1 planted the seed that could ripen in huge prosperity around, you know, down the road. So, yeah, so it could ripen in time. I don't want to be too wordy here tonight, but I am already starting out. Okay. A complete karmic action must have, so this is important, a complete karmic action. So there's karmic actions that are not complete and karmic actions that are complete. The ones that are complete are the ones that can project a whole lifetime. So to get reborn as a human being, what do we have to do? We had to practice ethics. We had to live ethically in a former lifetime, and some karmic seed that included all of these different things. So the first one is what? Intention. So intention has to be there. So you have to have. You want to practice ethics. So, for example, there's an opportunity to save a life, right? So you have the intention to save a life. Well, let's say it's a person. So we've got an object, and then you actually pull that person, you know, from in front of a speeding car. So there's the action, and then boom, we got the completion. So those four things need to be present for a complete karmic action. So if you committed suicide, let's don't go there. But, you know, certain karmic actions could happen. And, for example, you wanted to harm somebody or help somebody, and you did the action, but it really didn't save their lives. Or, you know, it wasn't complete. Okay. So you have to have all four. Incomplete actions produce karma. Yes or no? Yeah, will also produce karma. So, you know, maybe there's no intention. You just see somebody walking in front of traffic and you just instinctively grab them and pull them out of the way and save them. So you really didn't. By the way, I shouldn't say that because intention accompanies every action. But anyway, incomplete actions produce some karma. So we talk about complete actions that include all four can project us life as a human. Also, there are different realms of samsara. Right? We talk, a lot of you are new to Buddhism, but in Buddhism, if you walk outside, there's six cosmic realms, you might say. There are three upper realms and three lower realms. We call them the joyless realms. You don't want to be reborn there. You want to be reborn in a good realm, like a human being. That's a good realm. There are other realms like, they call it the jealous god realm and the deva realm, but those are the upper realms and the lower realms. Animals being reborn as an animal is not considered to be a fortuitous rebirth because you can't learn, you can't hear the teachings, you can't, you know, transform your mind and become a Buddha. Even though you have a consciousness, you're not able to understand the teachings. And then there's another one called that's caused by craving and grasping. It's called hungry ghost. or craving spirits is another way of talking about it. And then there's a realm, I have a realm, a really, really bad rebirth. So if we kill repeatedly and create a lot of negative karma, and it's a complete action, if that karma ripens at the time of the death in this life, our future life could be really hellacious. So that's part of Buddhist cosmology. You don't have to believe it, but it's something to think about. I'll tell you what, though, it makes you think twice when you get angry, when I get angry anyway, because I have some faith in karma. When I get angry, and I've done some meditation on the hell realms, like what it would be like to be born in hell, and I see, make the connection between me being like angry and being reborn there, it's like a slap in the face. It's a great mindfulness tool for me to be aware that everything's going to come back. I just poisoned myself. Everything's going to come back to me. So,
Don.
Yeah.
Back on number 5.
Yeah.
I think you marked that one incorrect. Number 5. One more up.
Because
it says it can only ripen in this lifetime or the next one immediately following.
Yeah, you're right.
We just want to make sure we're getting 100 on this.
Now, see, this gal uses, who taught this course, she uses different language than I'm used to. But anyway, let's talk about, so these are the 4 characteristics of karma. So one of them is karma is definite. Right? So what does that mean? Anybody want to say what that means? Yeah. Did you raise your hand? Yeah.
It's going to happen. It's definite.
Pardon?
It's going to happen if it's definite.
Well, here's what it means.
It will follow you around.
Yeah, true. But here's what this particular statement means. That positive actions will always ripen as happiness. And negative actions, and we're going to define positive and negative, always ripen in suffering. It's like if you plant an oak tree, you're not going to get a banana tree. You know, you're going to get if the seed is motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, it will always ripen as a positive action and always ripen as happiness. And any action motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance will always ripen as suffering. So karma is definite that way. There's no negotiation here. This is a fact. The Buddhist view of karma is that the seed you plant will ripen. Now, I'm going to back up a minute because we can actually purify karma. We'll talk about that in a minute. All right, so what's the next one? I'm sorry, but I may actually screw this thing up because I had trouble with this the first time I did it. But karma is definite. Then the next one is what? We're going to say karma's dynamic. Okay? Because remember we said it's expandable. This is a term Lama Zopa uses. It's expandable. Like a tiny karmic seed. Look at an oak tree. Starts out like a little acorn. And 40 years from now you got a 40-ton tree. It's a little tiny acorn. Ginormous tree. How did that happen? Karmic seeds are the same way. It's one tiny moment of anger or aversion plants a seed that, a year from now, 5 years from now, could result in huge suffering for ourselves. Because it's expandable. It could, some simple little thing like a thought could cause huge suffering for us down the road. I'll tell you, my nanny, bless her heart, she was boat riding this weekend with her husband out in, I guess, on Lake Jordan or someplace, and she busted her front tooth. It jammed up into her sinuses, and she had to go get some kind of retainer and all that kind of stuff. And I just saw her before I came here tonight, and I said, oh, Marlene, her name's Marlene. I said, I'm so sorry. She said, now, Anna, because Annabelle, my daughter, wears a retainer too. And she says, yeah, now Annabelle and I are both wearing retainers. And I said, well, the good news is, Marlene, this karma's finished. You know? So it can't get you now. We'll talk about this in a minute. That karma's done. That karma's finished. So no problems there. But karma's expandable. So this is something that a smart Buddhist pays attention to. The tiniest kindness that you can do, take advantage of the moment. Practice virtue as much as you can. Practice, you know, being kind to people. Smile at people. If you see a beggar, pull out a dime or a quarter or a dollar. You know, look for opportunities to practice virtue, the causes of happiness, because a little bit, a penny, but can become, you know, $1 billion, like in 10 years if you're lucky. You know, really lucky. But, you know, karma is expandable. So look at every opportunity you can to practice virtue, and any time you practice, be vigilant. Watch your mind carefully. Do not let your mind go on with thoughts of hatred and anger and fear and negativity, because we're planting seeds that are expanding exponentially and will cause huge suffering unless we uproot them right away. So this is the other thing about practicing every night. We'll do some purification practice in this class, but as much as possible, as soon as we do something wrong, apologize. If you said something that was mean or nasty, clean it up as quick as you can. Because it's just growing. And have you ever noticed that the longer you wait to clean up a mess, the harder it is? Have anybody noticed that? It does happen in real life. The longer you wait to go and apologize to somebody, the harder it is for them to get over it, because they've been stewing and ruminating about how much they hate you for having done that to them. So here we go again. Doggone it. Come on back. All right. So karma is definite. Now, see, she's using weird language here to me. Pardon? All right, so karma's dynamic. And here's the way we say it. You cannot experience a result without having created the cause. So it's specific. Yeah, so this is really the good one. You cannot experience a result without having created the cause. Anybody got a problem with that? Hello. That's hard, isn't it? That means that everything that's ever happened to you in your life is of your own not that you personally, your personality, but your stream of consciousness, you know, just like the River Nile as it goes through Africa changes names depending on the language of the country. But it's still the same continuity, right? So the continuity of our consciousness in some former lifetime planted seeds that are going to ripen in this lifetime. So everything that we experience is the fruit of former actions planted on our stream of consciousness. So we are 100%, 1,000,000% responsible, accountable for our lives. We can never, according to this teaching, we can never say we're a victim. Now, if somebody came in here and shot us all to death, would you say we were victims? I would. We are victims. Remember we talked about the superficial level and the deep level? On the superficial level, yeah. That's a legitimate thing to say. We are victims. If somebody, like, I know some people in here, if you look at a room full of people, a lot of people have been, I think something like 30% of women have been sexually assaulted. I was sexually assaulted when I was a kid, when I was 12 years old. Some jerk, you know, did something that he shouldn't have done. I remember it. But I'm not defined by that, but it did happen to me. I remember sitting in a classroom. I taught this class probably 20, not this class, but, you know, just an introduction to Buddhism class at the university. I'm telling this story because Joanna Smith and Bill Judge can validate if they remember. But there were two women in the class sitting, we were all sitting on the floor, and there were two women sitting side by side. And one woman had been raped by her father, you know, when she was like 4, 5, or 6 years. All the way through her childhood, she'd been raped. You know, you could never, and she had a big problem with this teaching on karma, as you can imagine. I'm responsible? Ah. Now, see, she saw responsibility as blame. And we're not saying that. We're not saying that. We're saying that this is the fruition of former actions planted on my mind stream when I was sexually assaulted. I didn't do anything to deserve that. I'm not to blame. You know, I didn't go to, you know, when that happened. But this is saying that, well, anyway, let me get back to this one lady, she was a total, she said, I am not to blame for my dad doing that to me. I mean, and she had been in therapy her entire life, really had defined her life. She was in her late 20s at the time, and she was on a whole bunch of medicine, and she was very, I mean, she was totally honest about it. She didn't hold anything back. She told us everything. And it was hard to disagree with her that she was a victim in a nominal, in a conventional sense. She was a victim. But from a deeper sense, from the understanding of karma, she was responsible. Okay? And sitting next to her was a lady who raised her hand and said, exactly the same thing happened to me when I was a kid. My father raped me from the time I was, or sexually assaulted me from the time I was about 6 or 7 years old until I was a teenager. And it was terrible. And I felt miserable about it. Now, by the way, I'm sorry if I'm saying anything that's triggering anything for anybody tonight. I apologize. But this is, but it happened to me. So I'm not talking about something that I haven't experienced. But this lady said, when I was 18 years old, I took a course and we talked about the value of being accountable, of taking responsibility for your life, not as a choice, not like I understood it, but as a choice. It's either a victim or responsible, isn't it? There's no third option, is there? You want to be a victim or responsible? Is there a third option? I'm serious. I want to hear it. Is there another way? I'm accountable for my life, 100% accountable, or I'm a victim. Okay. So maybe there is another. I'm waiting to learn what it might be. Or you could be a little bit of both.
I have a different way of looking at it that I'm coming to these classes out of thinking very similarly, but putting together my thoughts under some slightly different structures.
Right.
And curious how they align.
Right.
And so the way that I would explain that is that I would think that you're not necessarily responsible for what happens to you, but you are responsible for how you respond to it, and that your set of experiences set you up with a capability to respond to it.
Yeah.
So I still haven't quite grasped a concept. I haven't grasped an understanding of why that would make things easier, or I don't understand how to use that concept of being responsible for something from another lifetime or from another set of experiences that you weren't actually participating in.
Right.
I'm open to it. I just don't
see
it. So my way of the bridge there of how I would look at it is one of being accountable or responsible for how one reacts to a situation.
Yeah. And see, that's only according to Buddha Dharma. That's only part of it. And that is part of it. But we're saying that everything that happens to us, even the circumstances. This third law of karma, which is talking about specific, means that we cannot experience a result that we did not create the cause for. That's the third law of karma. So 100% we're responsible, we're accountable. That's where this is going. Now, and we're not asking anybody to believe this, but try it on for size. Try it on and see. I mean, clearly, we're responsible. I mean, it's not easy to make a good choice in a difficult situation. But yeah, it's easy. I think that's easy to see that we do have a choice. Something bad happens to us. Somebody harms us in some way. We have a choice how we react to that. But this is saying that the whole package, not only the choices that we make, but the circumstances are all part of karma. It's a bit hard. Again, this is hidden. Deeply hidden. Yeah.
Chrissy. I'm curious what you think about this. Instead of like personal responsibility just for this body and this consciousness, if we use this terminology might not be right, but if we use karma as a tool for our own minds and look at things through this understanding of karma now, we look at all the phenomena through this understanding, mm-hmm. then we can have compassion for ourselves, self-compassion for what has happened to us that we don't understand why it happened to us and that we didn't deserve, and right. therefore maybe any of the causes of that, let's say it be a father, an earthquake, a natural disaster, something like that in the past, and then have compassion for that occurrence or that being and see our interconnection just through that compassion lens of that you can understand that at the very basic level, if my father hurt me, then that means that he was hurting.
Yeah.
And so therefore, even if we don't understand all the circumstances, that maybe that's the responsibility part, is seeing the connections and where you fit into the puzzle of existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally true. If we understand karma, and, you know, somebody harms us for whatever reason, you know, they're just being used by their karma. People do have choices. It's true, but most of us are an automatic pilot. And so, you know, people that do bad things, you know, it's the fruit of their karma, and the victims of their bad actions. We use the nominally we call them victims, but you know, by the way, this is not a teaching that you go up to people, you know. I don't even need to say this, but you know, this is something that we need to think about ahead of time, and then use this to help us in the moment to not go to victimhood, but to go, okay, I just creatively align with the notion that I'm 100% responsible for my life, and I'm going to choose. I'm not going to go victim, angry, resentment, which is the slippery slope that victimhood often takes us down, but coming from accountability and responsibility, oh, I can choose how I'm going to react. So this, anyway. Yeah, go ahead. Question.
You are in control of your karma going forward.
Pardon?
You are in control of your karma going forward. So in my case, I was run over by a car walking through a crosswalk, and the car was doing 40 miles per hour, and she was a distracted driver. I figured out pretty early on that one of two things was going to happen. I was either going to get bitter or I was going to get better. And what I had to do very early on mm-hmm. was totally forgive this person. I don't even know who she is. I don't want to know anything about her. but I learned that I had to move forward at that point. Otherwise, if I stayed there, it would become hell for me. And because of choosing that, I can move around. I actually lived through it, which is something I was told I wasn't going to be. I was told much later that they thought I wasn't going to live through. And I also was able to keep my left arm and leg, which was something else they considered taking.
Well,
so it was at that point, very early on, and I realized I can't dwell there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm creating my own hell moving forward.
Right.
So I'm in charge of my karma going forward. I can't take care of what I can't, you know, stop what happened in the past. I can just only move forward.
Right. Good. Good for you. So what I'm hearing you say is, you rather than getting stuck in victimhood and anger and hating that person forever. I'll give you a quick story. Venerable Rabina gave this story. She goes to prisons, and she had there was a prison in Kentucky that she visited, and there was a man on death row, and he was a Christian, he was a Catholic, and he would go around death row with his daughter's rosary. His daughter had been murdered, violently murdered some years ago. And he would go around death row and pray with the guys on death row and let them borrow his daughter's rosary and so forth. And he had spent like, the story was that he had spent like 10 or 15 years just so angry at the man who had killed his daughter. And so full of hatred and anger. And in fact, the guy had died in prison and he was still angry. And so through his faith in Christ, and, you know, he sort of like, well, if the Lord can forgive him, then I can too. So then he was able to let go and not be a victim of this circumstance and destroy his life. And then he turned it around and started, serving the very people who had created the most horrific, you know, who were the worst of the worst in terms of prisoners and people in maximum security prisons that had done bad things. So very interesting. This is the hardest one. The one we're talking about now. All right. Then the fourth law of karma is what? It lies dormant. So this gets to the point where if whatever karma we've created, eventually it will ripen. What will cause it to ripen? The cooperative causes, right? The cooperative. So if we have the karma to be killed and we go to a war zone, we could actually experience that karma might ripen in Afghanistan, for example. Or if we have the karma to be wealthy, we might buy a lottery ticket. And boom, we hit the jackpot. So this is, karma is never lost. So again, we get back to this whole thing of every action of our body, speech, and mind, three ways we create karma, every seed planted, eventually, it is lying dormant. So we'd have a huge storehouse consciousness of karma. And it's all ripening right now. You know, billions of karmas ripening for us to see ourselves in this room and having whatever our experience is and for us to be a human being. And the karma for this life will end at some point, won't it? So it lies dormant. The karma for our death, we don't know what that is. We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know the circumstances. You thought, you know, when you were run over, you thought that was it. But karma is just lying dormant, waiting to ripen at some point in the future. Now, there's a way to keep it from ripening, this purification practice, so we'll talk about that. Please match the descriptions with the names of the general rules of karma. Sorry. If our intention is positive, our action will correspondingly positive and create positive imprints, mental predispositions. That was easy, isn't it? Karma's definite. Where is it? Okay? We cannot experience any result by which we have not created the cause. This is the one we're having trouble with. But something to think about. We also, this also means that we cannot take on the karma of other people. Even the Buddha cannot do this. So this was, karma is specific. Alright? Not only is the karmic result inescapable, in its nature, the karmic imprints we create in our mind stream will grow and produce results that are greater than their cause. That's dynamic. See, I never used this kind of language before, but we call it expandable. It's the way I've always talked about it before. Oh, I did? I meant dynamic. And karmic imprints are never lost, but can only come to fruition if we create the right conditions for them to ripen. This is a good one. So, dormant, right? So, like, if you're angry at somebody, for example, you've got a lot of issues with somebody. Sometimes it's good to avoid that person, isn't it? Rather than, you know, obviously the karma is going to have a greater chance of ripening if you're around somebody that creates a strong emotional response to you. So, they are the cooperative causes for either positive or negative karma to ripen. What is the meaning of the statement karma is dormant? This is a little bit repetitive. Conditions. What is the meaning of the statement karma is definite? Positive, negative, there's the answer. Positive karma ripens into positive results. By the way, Buddhism defines positive and negative based on the results. For example, if an action results in happiness, and I'm not talking about there's the experience in the moment of doing the action and then the long-term consequences of the action. If the long-term consequences of an action is happiness, that action is called virtue. And if the long-term consequences of an action is suffering, that action is called non-virtue. Now, you might go, well, that could be many lifetimes. How do we know what's virtuous and non-virtuous? And we rely on the teachings of the Buddha, but those of us who are being mindful in the moment will pay attention, because actions that are motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance are always going to cause happiness. And in the moment, actions are motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance are always going to result in suffering. And so we can be mindful in the moment. We can predict the long-term consequences of our actions of body, speech, and mind. Buddhism is non-theistic, and with no concept of a creator, no concept of redemption. I use the word redemption in one piece of the handout I had the other day, but I'll explain it later. But also no concept of guilt. So, only personal responsibility instead of a creator being. Buddhism has the principle of karma. So what is guilt? What is, when we say we're talking about guilt, what does that usually imply? Pardon? Like I'm a bad, anybody want to say?
I thought it implies that you were responsible in some way, so you feel bad about it.
Yeah, and you feel bad about yourself, usually, right? Usually there's that element of, I'm a bad person, like that. So that's not what karma is like. Karma is like, there's this story about these three guys that go to three Buddhists that go into a bar, right? And they're all, and the bartender, like pours them three drinks. And the first guy knocks it down, and then about 30 seconds later, and the other guy, just as this guy has finished, they're drinking them sequentially, right? First guy knocks it down, and 30 seconds later he falls over dead. And the second guy looks over and goes, I just drank the same thing he drank, and he falls over dead. And then the last guy's just got it in his, a mouthful of this poison, and he sees what's happened. What does he do? He spits it out. He doesn't want to die from the action. So karma is very much that way. We're poisoning ourselves when he drank the poison, this third guy, he didn't feel guilty or berate himself. He realized that he just poisoned himself, and so he spit it out. In the same way, when we perform actions that are non-virtuous, the skillful way to relate to that is to regret it. I regret having done that. I'm not a bad person. I just did a bad thing. You know, I did something stupid. And, you know, I've got all this karma. I'm out of control. I'm working on myself. But I made a mistake. And we try to clean it up. So that's how that is. So Buddhism's non-theistic. So Ajahn Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, this great Thai saint, when I was in Thailand many years ago, he was giving a teaching. He said Buddhism has a god. It's called the law of nature. He said, if you do this, you get that. If you do that, you get something else. It's just what every action has a result. It's very, he said it, it's an impersonal God. It's like gravity. It's just like gravity. Gravity is not personal, right? You jump off a 5-story building, you're pretty good chance you're going to die. It's not personal. So gravity's not personal. Karma's not personal. Karma is just how it is. And from the Buddhist perspective, whether you believe in it or not, this is how it is. And so it's useful to know that and try to orient our choices and our lives to live in accord with these laws of karma. So Buddhism has the principle of karma. That'd be true, right? All right. Understanding Buddha's definition of karma suggests that ultimately one is responsible for one's own happiness and suffering. Yep. Right? Pretty clear? True? Karma is fatalistic concept in that everything is controlled by our karma. We have no control over how we activate karmic imprints in our minds. That's false. We do have choice. This is a really tricky part about karma when you start thinking about it. Like, wait a minute, if everything's karma, how do I have a choice? But we do have a choice. And this is one of those things that's a little bit hard to understand, but from the Buddhist perspective, we do have a choice. So, false. Karma is not always produced by the body, speech, and mind. That is false. The mind is the chief, right? But the mind controls the body and the speech. So, Robina talks about it. Very difficult to control our mind, isn't it? So she says, what does she say? Anybody remember what she says? Yeah. what does Robina say? Because this is, Robina says, keep your mouth shut and your hands to yourself. Really? Because we can't control our minds. So gradually we'll be able to rein in our mind, and then we'll have more control over our speech and our body. The teachings also say when you're with others, watch your speech. When you're by yourself, watch your mind. Okay? When you're with others, watch your speech. When you're by yourself, watch your mind.
So, Don, when I answered that question, I got it wrong. And the reason I got it wrong is because lesson that was online, they said that, like, when we sneeze, that's not creating karma. So that question was like, karma is always being created. And what I interpreted from the teaching was that it's not always. There are these little moments like sneezing when we're not creating karma.
Actually, again, I have a hard time. I mean, that would be karma, but it'd be neutral karma. But in every finger snap, 64 moments of karma right there. We're creating karma all the time, 24/7, like that.
But constantly creating it. But in the online teaching, you said the only time we're not creating karma, you know, and one of the reasons, one of the times was like when we sneeze, we're not creating karma.
I'll have to go back to the thing.
I'll see what they say, but I got confused about that.
Yeah.
But that question does say karma is not always produced by the body, speech, and mind.
Actually, the answer's false.
Yeah.
But I,
sorry.
The question's confused.
I didn't see the word not.
Yeah.
I thought it should be true.
Yeah. Karma is not always being produced by body, speech, and mind. So it is always being produced. All right. Our mind stream is saturated with karmic seeds, positive or negative as well. They lie dormant, but create a potential ability on our consciousness. That means they will ripen when appropriate conditions come together. That's true. Help me here, people. I'm really screwing this up. Positive karmic seeds do not expand or increase in our mind stream. It's only negative imprints that expand. No, positive. That's false. Positive seeds can expand. We do not create any positive karma or virtue if an action is spontaneous. That's silly. Buddhist notions of karma suggest that one can ignore others' suffering and that social injustice no longer needs to be considered. That's false. Oh, that, you know, you hear some people go, well, that's just his karma. Too bad, that's just your karma that you're suffering or something. That's not the point of karma at all. Yes, bad things do happen, and they are caused by karma. But that doesn't mean that a compassionate, active, sometimes even forceful response is not justified. And last but not least, we should always attempt to feel a degree of compassion for the perpetrators of suffering, simply because they store up such appalling bad karma for themselves in the future. True. Now, I remember after 9/11, I wrote something. I've forgotten where it got. But anyway, I wrote I actually remember Richard Gere at Madison Square Garden got up and said something about the perpetrators, the guys who flew the planes into the building, how we should have some compassion for them, and they booed him out of there. Because, you know, but, you know, sometimes we should have, the perpetrators are the ones that maybe even more than the victims. All right, so that is all of that. So we're done for tonight. So I did my best. We covered the debt. We covered some material. This next week we're going to do meditations on the four laws of karma, and we're going to talk about the 10 non-virtuous actions and, you know, what justifies a non-virtuous action and the qualities or the different aspects of non-virtue and virtuous actions and so forth. So that's really important because we need to know what to practice and what not to practice, and we've talked about that a little bit tonight. So let's take a moment to do a little dedication, and we don't have the... Sorry, I've gone over tonight. I just got... So at the end of the teachings, we like to think that we have planted a lot of karmic seeds. Hopefully, the ones that we planted are virtuous. I'm going to say they are. These are the trying to grapple with this subject of karma and trying to understand it, and then hopefully find something that useful that we can put into practice this next week that will make our lives better, not only today, tomorrow, but in the future as well. So we want to dedicate that, all of the seeds that we planted, not only to ourselves, but to our family, our community, the people that we come into contact with on a daily basis, then our larger community and the world and beyond. We want to dedicate that merit so we can imagine that as a light going out from our heart, you know, going to the furthest reaches of the universe as we dedicate this, the positive potential, or we call it merit, to the benefit of all living beings. Okay. Well, thank you for your attention. And so if you can go online and do the second quiz, there are four quizzes, if you are so inclined. There's a meditation on the four characteristics of karma. Now that is in the readings. It's in the Lama Zopa, teaching, the wish-fulfilling golden sun, okay, on page 70 or something, the four laws of karma. Remember, karma is definite, so positive leads to positive, negative to negative. Karma is expandable, so can it grow? You cannot experience a result without creating a cause. And the results of karma are never lost. So those are the four things that we need to meditate on this week. Think about, okay? So we'll talk about that and more next week.